bet John's already thinking, if we come up for an orchestral music time, is it?
Be careful what you're saying.
I could just get maybe a suitor.
One quick suitor.
Well, a
3-hour ride is for me, it's enough time for about 7 suitors up.
In the van on the way up. There you go.
I think if your people have any brains, you'll put me in the way back.
Well, I was thinking on the roof.
You just all get little TVs.
Yeah.
It's what I do. I had a great friend of mine. His name was Robert Wolf. He lived in Volcano, Hawaii. He just passed away about 18 months ago. And he was one of the most interesting men in the world. He was an anthropologist. He was a mechanical engineer and a chemical engineer. That's just the beginning of who he was.
Smart
guy. But he also spent a lot of time. He was an amateur anthropologist, but he was probably the preeminent anthropologist in the world. He told me the story one time. He was in, and I can't remember the country, but he was in an African country, but out in the woods. And he came across a village that had never, this is like the 1960-something, that had never seen outside people.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked into the village, and he immediately was welcomed. There was no fear. There was no rejection. It was just, and he couldn't understand this because he had been in so many places that you have to work your way in
mm-hmm.
any society. He was immediately a part of the society, and they gave him his own little hut. This is a good story, so let me broadcast it. So they gave him his own little hut, and made him comfortable, and he noticed, and he was there for a few days, and he noticed that there was one little guy, a little old man, that would, when there's nobody else around, he would go into another person's hut and come out with stuff and bring it in his hut. And he did this repeatedly over a few days. And Robert went up to the leader and he said, "I'm really curious. You must know what's going on here." And the leader, the chief, said, "You mean so-and-so?" And he says, "Yeah, that's what I'm talking about." He says, "Why do you allow him to steal your stuff?" And he says, "Well, he's a thief." And that was it. That's what he does. And within our community, so what? We can allow for thieves. Plus, they knew where their stuff was. What a marvelous story. He was a great guy. And he wrote quite a few books that are very difficult to read, but he wrote one book, and I wish I could find it. I wish I could find it in my library. It's available. It's called What It Is to Be Human, and it's just a great book, and it's got to be available on Amazon. I'll put it on the book list. Tomorrow, it's interesting how our retreats the last 2 years have ended on a very special day in Buddhism
mm-hmm.
called Vesak Day, which is the celebration in some traditions of the Buddha's birthday. That's what they're celebrating. In some traditions, it's the celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment. In some traditions, it's just we're celebrating the Buddha's life and what he did for us. Sometimes it's called Bodhi Day. We had the Bodhi Day celebration at Tinaka
mm-hmm.
Martin Science that 1 year. And it's unplanned, but it's kind of interesting. You know, it's not karma. It's not the universe pulling strings for us, but it's nice to be here on Vesak Day. So that'll be tomorrow. And there is a celebration here, but we will be listening to more Dhamma talks. Let me start tonight with this very short sutta. And Lorna got me thinking about it when she brought that up. But what do you do when you're just caught up in this jumble of thoughts and you can't seem to get out of it? And any sutta is appropriate. Coming to the breath is appropriate. Reading the Anattalakkhana Sutta is appropriate. But this is the Buddha's response to exactly the same question that was put to him. What do you do when you're caught up in this jumble of thoughts? The Buddha was at Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. He addressed those assembled. When one is intent on developing heightened mindfulness, there are 5 qualities of mind they should attend to. Number 1, when one's thoughts are unskillful and arising from craving and delusion, they should be mindful of their unskillful thoughts in order to abandon unskillful thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Follows in line with all the Buddha's teaching, doesn't it? Be mindful of what's occurring. If it's rooted in ignorance, simply abandon it. Once unskillful thoughts have been abandoned, they can now cultivate skillful thoughts guided by the Eightfold Path. In other words, it's saying when you remove these unskillful thoughts, you now have room in your mind and a clear direction to develop skillful thoughts within guided by the Eightfold Path. With unskillful thoughts abandoned, one's mind calms and concentration increases simply by abandoning unskillful thoughts. Number two, if that doesn't work, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion arise again, one should be mindful of the suffering brought by these thoughts, recognizing, in quotes, these thoughts are unskillful and will lead to more confusion, delusion, and stress. Being mindful of the drawbacks of unskillful thoughts, these thoughts can now be abandoned. With unskillful thoughts abandoned, one's mind calms and concentration increases. Number three, if those two fail, those are my words, by the way, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion continue to arise while being mindful of the drawbacks of these thoughts, one should simply pay no attention to these thoughts. Instead of analyzing it, where they come from, why am I having it, simply pay no attention to it. By mindfully withdrawing attention to these unskillful thoughts, these thoughts are abandoned and will subside. So Lorna was describing being caught up in those thoughts and they're not subsiding. And even with all the effort and the understanding that Lorna has, they're still there. What to do? With unskillful thoughts abandoned, one's mind calms and concentration increases. Number four, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion continue to arise while being mindful of the drawbacks of these thoughts, now, again, this is someone now who has developed a Dhamma to a certain extent, like Lorna has, and it's still not working. Be mindful of the drawbacks of these thoughts. One should focus on relaxing the mental fabrications with regard to these thoughts. Just like settling down in an easy chair at the end of a long day. That's what we do in our minds. Just relax. Stop fighting it. Let them be. Come back to the breath. You see how it relates to the initial instructions on the four foundations of mindfulness. With the intentional relaxation of mental fabrication, one's mind calms and concentration increases. Right intention. I want to read it again. With the intentional relaxation of mental fabrications, one's mind calms and concentration increases. How can we do that if we're caught up in our thoughts to generate the willful intention to simply relax my thoughts? It takes a well-concentrated mind, doesn't it?
Can I just ask
something? Yes.
I think the instructions about watching your body breathe, when I've always gone to my cushion, tried to meditate, I've always gone like the mental route, like thinking of my thoughts and abandoning them and going to my breath, which is through my thoughts. I have not tried focusing my thoughts on my body to see what my body is doing and interpreting what my body is doing with the thought and going that route. Does that make any sense?
It does, and you're actually anticipating what the Buddha's going to say.
Don't take a bow now.
You should.
Don't start.
You should take a bow.
You get an extra cookie for that.
We have cookies?
Rumors.
Can we get to the cookies now?
Yeah, I was going to say cookies. And throw your iPad.
Restrain John.
Could you give me a hamburger today and I'll surely repay you? That's definitely unskillful to introduce Wimpy to a retreat, but that's my conditioned mind. Number five, if unskillful thoughts driven by craving and delusion continue to arise while being mindful of relaxing the mental fabrications with regards to unskillful thoughts, one should develop right intention in order to abandon unskillful thoughts with continued refined mindfulness. In other words, if you got to the point where it's just not working, what do you do? Continue with Dhamma practice. Continue to refine your mindfulness through right intention. With the intentional abandonment of unskillful thoughts, one's mind calms and concentration increases. Now, when a practitioner recognizes unskillful thoughts, understands unskillful thoughts, paying no mind to unskillful thoughts, attending to the relaxing of mental fabrications with regards to those thoughts, and using right mindfulness and right intention to steady their mind. Remember how the Buddha talks about steadying the mind, focusing on steadying the mind and calming mental fabrications. He's, again, going back to the four foundations of mind. And right intention to steady the mind, settle the mind, unifies their mind, and concentrates their mind right within. What was Lorna just talking about? Right within what?
The body.
Right within the body. And of course, the Buddha could have said that, and the translator could have put it in there, but we know because we understand what the Buddha is referring to when he's talking about steadying the mind right within, within the body. Great anticipation.
Breathing in sensitive to the body.
Yeah.
Yes.
This, now the Buddha continues, the
yes.
one that can do that, this is a person with mastery of thought sequences. They understand how their thinking works. That's what these slightly more fancy words mean. This person thinks, this is the culmination of the goal, by the way, this person thinks what they want to think whenever they want and does not think what is unskillful. Imagine having a mind like that. That's a pure mind. And we gain that through concentration and the refined mindfulness that's provided through the Eightfold Path. We think what we want to, moment by moment. Each one of our thoughts is then a skillful thought. And it's a thought that's generated out of wisdom. And it's a thought that's always appropriate to what's occurring. It's not a reactionary thought. It's not a thought that will lead to the second arrow. It's a mind resting in equanimity that can think what it wants to think whenever it wants to think so. And so what would a... Now we have this mind that can think whatever it wants to think. But the mind has... A mind that doesn't have the framework of the Eightfold Path thinks whatever it wants to think whenever it wants to think it. But it's unrestrained. And it's reactionary. But now that mind through... In other words, that people don't like to ascribe to what they're doing. A mind that is well-trained thinks what it wants to think whenever it wants to think it, but from appropriate right view. There's no conflict that could arise in those thoughts. There's no ignorance. There's no fetter left in that type of thinking. And so the thought will naturally be a peaceful, calm, and meaningful thought. It won't take us out of where we're supposed to be, within our body. And that is, Matt was alluding to this, that's not fabricated because it's I want to use the word automatic, but it's not really that. It's the result of a mind that is unified with its body. And a mind that's not can't do that. But a mind that is cannot not do it. It's just a natural progression of being a fully mature human being. I want to talk a little bit about that if we have some time, about where that came from. This practitioner has severed craving and has brought an end to suffering and stress. That's the end of that sutta. We did another one.
I remember reading a sutta where that same progression was used, and he ends with, and if that doesn't work, then you put your tongue up against your palate and you crush the thought.
Yeah.
Sava Sava Sutta.
Yeah, that's
it. And you what?
You crush
it. Crush the thought with your right intention, which sounds pretty harsh, but what it just points to the level of intention that we need to have. Crush the thought. And we should be willing to crush those hurtful thoughts, those unskillful thoughts, shouldn't we? That again, I don't know why I keep using it. Second time I keep using it. That is anathema to an ignorant mind, because it doesn't want to, it's enamored with each and every thought. And tell that mind that you got to crush those, I'm not crushing anything. But a mind that is well concentrated and understands why now it's time to crush the mind, crush those thoughts, does it joyfully, with joyful engagement, because it knows where it's leading.
And usually that's the most egotistical moments.
It is,
when
yeah.
you're totally wrapped up in somebody offended you, somebody cut you off, somebody, and you're just
really holding on to.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the, you
yeah.
know, the bottle rocket, and you're there. And then you have to talk yourself.
Yeah, and your thoughts are swirling around justifying the feeling and the thought and everything else. And that's, again, there's the feedback loop.
Yeah.
And at that point, you have literally lost your mind.
Yeah.
And so you can't struggle with that. The Buddha's teaching here, recognize that that's what's occurring and do what you can to extricate. And he gives us five specific things that we can do. And then if all else fails, crush the thought. Eliminate it. Get rid of it. And that's okay. We can do that. We can have that strong intention, and we have the inner capability to actually do it, or the Buddha wouldn't tell us to do it. He wouldn't suggest something that we're not capable of doing. Even though we might have to keep coming back to it and over and over again. We might find ourselves in that same mental quality again. But now, because we've already been through it once, there's not as much fear, for one thing, and we know what to do. In that sense, we're developing a good habit to supplant that bad habit, much like the Buddha said. The mind is either this way or it's that way.
So you're refining your practice, you're refining mindfulness.
Yeah.
Because it does no good just to catch it and be aware of it and crush it, because that's just a cycle.
Yeah.
But is also saying, get back to work, you need to refine this.
Yeah.
You need to be who you are.
Yeah.
It's great to know that, okay, in contact, that's when it happens. But who cares? I mean, it's too late. You have to
prevent it from happening.
Yeah.
Or avoid it from happening.
Yeah.
Next time.
And again, even when the Buddha's referring to different qualities that have yet arisen, referring to that. He's reminding us that we need to train ourselves to do this. There's specific skills to develop to accomplish certain tasks. And in along the way, those are the broad strokes, and now the Buddha's saying in a very specific situational way, this is what you do. But it always, and you can see the understanding of dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness in his response. It's all part of that. And it's all tied into understanding five clinging aggregates, et cetera, et cetera. And those other things that he's talked about in both the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta.
Can we just go back to when Lorna said she's caught up in her thoughts? And you're caught up in your thoughts. One of the things you can do is to say, this is impermanent. Let it be. It will go away.
Mm-hmm.
But that can also turn into a cycle.
Yeah. It can become, like Jen was talking about, that it can become too rote.
Yes.
So that's why the Buddha gives us...
Then what's the next step after that?
Always the next step when the Dhamma is not working is to go find the root of a tree or an empty hut.
Yeah. Okay.
And intentionally, meditation is an intentional act to calm the mind every time we do it, to develop concentration. And so when all else fails, it's not a bad idea to take refuge on your cushion. But like we talked about yesterday, sometimes it doesn't work. So there's other tools available to us through the suttas. You can read the Anatta Lakkhana, you can read this sutta, you could read this or that. And I would say if all that else fails, it's okay to go take a walk on the towpath too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Liz brought that up. And that's all part of a Dhamma practice too, isn't it? But we continue to keep coming back to it over and over and over again because we know we've taken refuge that this will work. We have developed that strong sada, the conviction, to continue with this. And that's why right effort is so important, to remind ourselves that when we're in a seemingly hopeless quality of mind, that it's not, that we know what to do. We're not lost, we're not stuck. We're just in this temporary state. Come back to the sensation of breathing.
I like this because it talks about he methodically approaches, you know, okay, if the thought arises, try this. If the thought arises again, even though you tried that, try this. Thought arises again, try this. And it's showing you this progression of, because the thought will most likely begin, you know, continue to arise, and you will have to continue to practice and practice to continue to do it moment to moment to moment. You have to keep doing it
Yeah.
until
What might happen is the more you experience the past, right?
Yeah.
The more you're like, oh wow, this works,
yeah,
right?
Right.
This can work even in my big issues.
Oh yeah.
Things I haven't overcome yet, you know.
In a sense, the Buddha is saying difficulties will arise.
Mm-hmm.
This is not
yeah.
This is not a palliative dhamma. Difficulties will arise. This is what you do when they arise.
Mm-hmm.
If this doesn't work, try this. If that doesn't work, okay, here's something else you can try. And but he says in the sutta, but always come back to the Dhamma, to your Dhamma practice. That's true refuge. So let's meditate, and then we'll have the fire discourse. Our meditation session has been edited out. Guided Shamatha Vipassana meditations of various lengths are available at becoming-buddha.com. Before we get started on the next sutta, Kevin asked me a brilliant question.
Before you go to that one,
yes,
ask you one more thing.
Sure.
It's kind of continuing on what Ram just said earlier in the last sutta you read. Ram, you said in the past, you know, when you just said crush the thought, and I've actually, my sits have not been the way yet. It just hadn't been as calm for whatever reason. And in the past, you've mentioned that if our mind is overactive, we breathe slower to slow the thoughts down, without too much manipulation. And if you're drowsy, you've said before, you know, maybe a slightly quicker breath without too much manipulation. And that to me just felt like you just said, to crush a thought with mindfulness of the breath, but without too much manipulation. I don't know if that was anything or not, but
it
seemed to work for me, because I think I haven't been breathing, and again, not too much in the mechanics of the breathing, but I've almost been too quiet with my breathing, too relaxed, just too soft, and not crushing it, not crushing the thought with, I'm gonna breathe into my body, breathe into my, you know, feel the sensation of being, really feel it. And in this case, to slow down the thoughts, it had to be a little bit more pronounced breath. So I don't know if that had anything to do with anything. And
it did. Thank you for bringing it up. Everything the Buddha taught was situational. In the Sabbasabba Sutta, the word, and again, it's a translation, but using that powerful word, crush, was appropriate to who was present at the time. But in the context, we know that what he means by crushing the thought is, as the thought's coming up and disturbing us, we crush it by coming back to the sensation of breathing. But you're not describing breath manipulation. You're simply, and this is something that relates almost to what you said before at dinner. This is how we refine our practice. This is how we refine our mindfulness. And this is the personalization, if you will, of Dhamma practice. We find within the overarching framework what works for us. And that doesn't mean that we pick and choose the Eightfold Path. We integrate the entire Eightfold Path, and within that, we develop essentially our own Dhamma practice. But it's within that proper framework. The brilliance of the middle way is it allows us to be human beings, which means it allows us to be individual reference point on the progression of awakening. Do you see? You can't shake your head because I can.
Yes.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say, because when I heard crush the thought, my first, and this was reaction, was, oh, that's too something.
Too harsh.
Too harsh. Okay. Yeah. For me, because my tendency initially was always to kind of bear down on the thoughts and like try to suppress the thoughts. So crushing felt the same, but then I kind of just let that go, that initial reaction. And then I just thought about intention. You know, what's the intention here? The intention is to have resolve about staying with the breath. And I even, the same thing with that minute, this particular meditation did, as the thoughts arose, I had a strong, you know, powerful
resolve.
Thoughts arose, I approached it with the same resolve to to abandon that thought.
You brought the suggestion back within the framework of the Eightfold Path.
Right.
And this is another wonderful example of how Asanga works. By Ram reminding us, all of us, about the Sabbasava Sutta, he introduced something that was useful that otherwise wouldn't have been introduced during this retreat. That's how it works.
And the odd thing is, I never knew what to do with that particular
And so the right intention then guides us to gently crush the thought. And for some people, that works. And so what you will do in meditation when you want to gently crush the thought, you'll come back to your sense of breathing. Mm-hmm. To people that object to that or can't process the word crush, what they'll do in meditation is gently come back to their breath. Mm-hmm. The answer is the same.
Yeah.
The application is slightly different and situational to who's here.
Well, the other examples have been severed with thought.
Yes.
With a sickle.
Yes, cut it at the root. That's often the
right.
Metaphor, is that, if that's the right word here.
And
so those are pretty harsh words, but it's just directing us to the intention that's necessary to cut at the root of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And those are perfect metaphors, aren't they? Because that's exactly what we're doing.
He's also in other sutras, right, referred to the mind in the water snake sutta, right? I mean,
yep, the Alagadhapama Sutta.
That's a pretty tough thing to, you got to have some resolve. You're trying to fight a water snake. So, and you may have to fight your mind a little and situationally and crush it with a breath, you know, in the gentle way. And you may have to overpower the mind with your breath, with the sensation of breathing.
Yes.
That was very, you know, I think with the progression of the Anapanasati Sutta, now that we have understood that, this, what Ram said, must have said that a year or so ago or more, and
that's
how Asanga works.
And to someone who had no understanding of this, to someone who had no understanding of the Dhamma, and if the first thing they heard and there was no context presented, they're going to run away from meditation forever if they hear the purpose of meditation is to crush thoughts.
Right.
But because we understand the context, we understand that the Buddha is talking about a gentle crushing.
Right.
But we also understand the benefit of the outcome. So if you're having a volatile thought, or if you have a tendency towards those kinds of heightened reactions, then crushing it would get it contained, and then you would see the benefits of that. So maybe the next time it comes up, it can be in a more gentle way.
Oh yeah.
Repressed or not repressed, but cut at the root or whatever.
Yeah.
Abandoned.
And that's true about almost anything we do.
Sometimes our thoughts come through and we think they're solid objects.
Yes.
That this piece of,
they're like
solid
a globophone.
Wood has, you know, this thought of, you know, the density of oak, you know, is real and important and scary. And then you realize that it doesn't have form and it doesn't have to be true.
Yeah.
And we're the ones giving it power.
Yeah, and we know that a piece of oak, a steel beam, there's no solidity there either, is there? It's if we look at it with enough of a powerful microscope, we see the wave in the particle in that whatever it is. Nothing's solid, nothing's, and even something as solid as a piece of iron doesn't last. What were you talking about we shouldn't get into it, the chains that they were making steel out of. We can't find anything that's impermanent, but most importantly, what is impermanent is our thoughts. And so with a gentle crushing, however we apply that, we awaken. And the teaching is always consistent in that way. I do want to touch on this. So let's get into that briefly. Would you just describe that a little bit?
Well, we were talking about dependent origination, Jimmy and I, and sort of recounting it, and it occurred, you've referred to it as dependent co-arising, and often breaking the chain, we can relate or process occurs to us. And that led me to the question of, does dependent origination, is there a chain we often refer to it as happening outside of time or in micro time? Is it all happening maybe at the same time or as close to the same time as could be?
Yeah. And so my answer was, for all intents and purposes, it's simultaneous. And it took an awakened human being's mind to describe a simultaneous process in such intimate and useful detail. But we can also get caught in the weeds of dependent origination.
Mm-hmm.
What's most important is to remember that from ignorance, suffering arises. And that directs us directly to Dhamma practice, to the Four Noble Truths. And then along the way, we can start, as we've done here, developing a familiarity with each one of those links. And now it's also true that the reason why it's called a chain of dependencies is like a chain. When you cut, sever one link, the whole chain falls apart. And that is true about dependent origination. When any one of those links is realized and abandoned, the whole thing falls apart. But, and I only use the term dependent co-arising because that's a common term, but I think it's a misleading term.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't relate to directly to suffering, the origination of suffering dependent on ignorance. But it does, everything does, it's accurate in that way of everything, it happens simultaneously. It's outside of time. The Buddha also refers to that, and the word that he uses is relating to the timeless path. The path itself is outside of time. It's not, Jen was talking about this too, that ignorance requires, and this is really brilliant, ignorance requires linear time. It requires the structure of linear time. An awakened mind is outside of time. It's no longer stuck in the linear progression of past, present, future. It's simply present.
Then an ignorant mind might look for that linear progression in the chain of
dependencies. Yeah, and that's where you get caught up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's and when you read the sutta, of course, it takes a period of time to read the sutta because that's how our minds work, unless you're Evelyn Wood. Ignorance, suffering arises. It's in between, it's not unimportant. It's unnecessary. Because the Buddha did not teach dependent origination, his first teaching, and he probably didn't teach it for at least a couple of years because there was no context. And there wasn't any, because there was no context, there was no importance to it. There was no way to apply it. And dependent origination is not only taught in the Paticca-samuppada sutta. I've come across probably a dozen different suttas where the Buddha refers to it, but the Paticca-samuppada sutta is the primary sutta that is taught. One of the reasons why I wanted Kevin to bring that up and Jen, there's nothing that makes a teacher happier. Why do people cry when they're happy? Than to hear a Sangha discussing the fine points of the Dhamma. That's remarkable. And I've been in hundreds of Buddhist situations, and I've never ever heard discussions like that. That really is remarkable.
That's what this retreat feels like, the finer points.
It is, because we're ready for the finer points. But we're engaged in it.
Right.
And so here's Jen, and again, excuse me for using Ed's example. You could have been talking about anything else, including the Yankees are in first place. What's important here? The finer points of the Dhamma. And we're talking about our insights to it, and we're sharing it with others. That's a Sangha. That's the importance of a Sangha. And we can't do it alone, can we? It takes the three jewels, the three refuges.
Mm-hmm.
And what an example of that than that question. So that was great, Sariputta. And I'll call you Kenma. Wonderful. So again, I'd like your feedback on this. It's a few minutes after 8. I can read through the Fire Discourse, and we probably have a little bit of time to discuss it, or we could continue a little bit of a discussion, and we could just have that tomorrow, and we'll leave those other two suttas out. I'll miss my... By the way, I'm just kidding about setting a record. You understand that, don't you? I hope you do. So again...
I think we've got to go for it.
Yeah. All right, that's what I.
I don't know what I would do Saturday night in a retreat.
Here we go. Hold on to your seats.
Just set a record.
After that discussion, we gotta go into this.
Right.
Oh, yeah, and I wanted to go back to the Anatta Lakana Sutta because that leads directly to what we're going to talk about. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. When liberated, there is knowledge that they are liberated. I do this on Saturday nights too.
We almost made it through. Almost. Tears.
I'm really worried about my talk tomorrow because I'm thinking about it. And I'm laying in bed crying about it.
Oh.
Don't do that.
What are you crying for?
That just reinforces the condition.
That
it's just a little bit clamped. That's all.
They understand. Birth is exhausted. The integrated life has been lived out. What can be done is done. Of this, there is no more beyond. And I left this out this afternoon. Now, during this discourse, the hearts and minds of those five bhikkhus, the four additional ones, were liberated from craving, aversion, and deluded thinking, which means they awakened. And there's it's not a misprint. It was a misinformation in the lead up to the fire discourse, where it says this is about a month after the Buddha's beginning his teaching career. Nobody really knows, but it's likely, when I looked at it a little bit more, it's probably 2 to 3 months. The time frame really doesn't matter, except that's really misinformation. It's a little bit longer than that.
Just because of the progression from the second to the third?
Yeah, and I started looking at the characters. And the reason why and where this was given, it's just unreasonable to expect it that within a few weeks of the Buddha's teaching, there's going to be 1,000 people ready, not just hearing him, but ready to hear him. Mm. That they had to have an environmental understanding of that there's an awakened human being in the world and he's teaching something important. Let's go hear him. The fire discourse, and also the reference to the different cults that were present at the time, even the Buddha must have taken a little bit of time to integrate the environment that he was within. The fire discourse. The Buddha presented, I don't need to read the introduction. And that's where I mentioned about 1 month, it's probably 2 or 3. The Buddha was staying at Gaya. Well, no, that's another reason why I think it took a little bit longer. He had now traveled out of Asali. The Buddha was at Gaya Head with 1,000 monks. There he addressed those monks. Monks, the all is a flame. What all, and again, excuse me for interrupting, I'm going to try to read through this, but relate this to dependent origination and the Buddha's reference to eye consciousness, ear consciousness, etc. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Whatever's coming into our eyes, if it were rooted in ignorance, it's simply inflaming our passion. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. Even our indifference to what's occurring, or ambiguity, if it's coming into contact to an ignorant mind, it can't help but inflame our passions. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. What are those last three in reference to? The three defilements. Could be said greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Same thing. Passion, greed, craving, it's all the same. And a more stronger term might be greed, hatred, and deluded thinking. But it's not too harsh to use that term occasionally, isn't it? Because we have to admit there's hatred in the world, and it's obvious every day. And it's good to acknowledge that level of aversion has now risen to hatred. Because if we can acknowledge it in the outer world, we might be able to acknowledge it in ourselves. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, regrets, pains, distresses and despairs, a flame of dukkha. The ear is a flame. And I'll just add this word. The ear is a flame, and so sounds are a flame. Mm-hmm. By looking at it that way, we'll no longer become inflamed with sounds. That doesn't mean we'll never hear a beautiful symphony. We shouldn't listen to a beautiful symphony or anything else we want to listen to. But we won't become inflamed by it. It'll simply be a present abiding. And think about that when you can take eye making out of our music. It has such a much more meaningful and mindful presence. We've got to talk about that thing coming up on June the 9th. The ear is a flame, sounds are a flame, the nose is a flame, and so aromas are a flame. The tongue is a flame, and flavors are a flame. The body is a flame, and so tactile sensations are a flame. The intellect is a flame. This is probably the most difficult one for us to really accept. But it's the intellect, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. The intellect is a flame. We're so enamored with our intellect, aren't we? Mm-hmm. The intellect is a flame, and so ideas are a flame. What we produce out of this intellect rooted in ignorance, ideas and ideology, is a flame. And look at the ideology that's present in the world today and how it inflames passions, how it divides people. In this country, the different ideologies that are continually crashing into each other, and both sides aren't willing to look at the ridiculousness of maintaining that fight and let it go. The intellect is a flame, ideas are a flame. Consciousness at the intellect is a flame. Contact at the intellect is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on, contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. Nothing escapes this. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fires of aversion, and the fires of delusion. The Buddha says, a flame, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, regrets, sins, pains, distresses, and despairs. What's the Buddha describing there?
Dukkha.
A flame with dukkha. Seeing clearly, a well-instructed disciple of the Noble One grows disenchanted with the eye. They grow disenchanted with forms, internal and external. They grow disenchanted with consciousness at the eye. They grow disenchanted with contact at the eye. Disenchanted with contact at the eye. So now I'm able to take in what's occurring through my senses, in this case, the eye. And because I'm disenchanted, I've learned that this is whatever I'm encountering is impermanent and it's not me. There's no enchantment with it. What is enchantment? Look at Alice in Wonderland. It's a great example of enchantment. It's an excitable experience of deluded thinking, isn't it?
It's mental.
Look at all the me out there.
Yeah.
Drink me.
What a perfect word. Now again, if you weren't ready to hear this, people say, what do you mean? I want to be enchanted with my life. But they don't understand the danger in that way of thinking. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too they grow disenchanted. They grow disenchanted. I got a little piece of dinner left. Excuse me. They grow disenchanted with the nose. They grow disenchanted with the tongue. They grow disenchanted with the body. They grow disenchanted with the intellect. It doesn't say it here, but they grow disenchanted with the whole mass of suffering. They grow disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates. They grow disenchanted with ideas. They grow disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect. They grow disenchanted with contact at the intellect, and whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they grow disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. They lose craving and desire through disenchantment. Through dispassion, they are fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge, I'm fully released. They discern that birth is ended, the integrated life fulfilled, the task is done. There is nothing further for this world. This is what the Buddha said, the translation is the Blessed One said. Gratified, the monks delighted at his words. And while this explanation was being given, the hearts of the thousand monks, through no clinging, not being sustained, were fully released from the fermentations and effluence. They awakened. It's the end of that sutta. Another one in the book. Isn't that marvelous, the direct teaching, and now we understand the context of it?
That is so
direct. We've been doing this sutta on Saturday night, I think, since the first one, because it just fits right now. I'm glad you said you didn't let me put it off till tomorrow. What a marvelous thing to become disenchanted with eye making, to become disenchanted with the entire mass of suffering, rather than enchanted with the entire mass of suffering.
Mm.
When I think I said it the first day, I can't remember anymore, I'm getting a little punchy. The Buddha could almost as accurately describe saying that there is dukkha as saying there is distraction. And this relates directly to that. It's because we're enchanted with dukkha that we're distracted by dukkha. And so anything that we can do to maintain that distraction, ignorance, we want to maintain because we have now joined with dukkha. How do we disjoin from dukkha? Matt has the answer.
This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself.
Yeah.
And that's becoming disenchanted with contact is just, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself.
Yeah. And where would we as human beings come in contact with the phenomena? Through the sixth sense base.
Yeah. I was going
to
say
so,
a pastry shop, but...
That could do it. So, yeah, we got to get there. So the...
A segue.
I had to I'm gonna take the segue in just a moment. One more thing, as I like to say occasionally. Did everybody notice my Lamborghini the other day when I was talking? The first time, and maybe the first 100 times, you heard the sixth sense base or the sixth sense media. Why the hell are they even talking about this? How does it apply? Because you didn't have the context yet. And even if, though you might have heard it a few times in context, it takes a while to understand it. But now you see it's basic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's basic because it's us. It's part of who we are in the continuum of awakening. And so we use what we are to awaken and become what we aren't.
Ignorant.
Yeah. We're mindful. The Buddha teaches us to be mindful of what's present and be mindful of what's not present. To be mindful of the emptiness of ignorance, the emptiness of clinging. So I'm going to end this again on that note.
Mm.
Let's go have some cookies.
That's not being a negativa, right?
It is. And
becoming what we aren't.
And if you weren't willing to embrace the negative, if you were so caught up in everything has to be positive or there's something wrong.
Right.
You cannot do that. And I don't like the word embrace. If you weren't willing to encounter the negativity, the ignorance, how can you get rid of it? And the Buddha understood that. So he taught, the phrase wasn't there, so he taught via negativa, to show us what's wrong. Just like a good doctor, you go to a good doctor and you're coughing and hacking and he notices you got a pack of Marlboros, he's not going to ignore the obvious. He's going to say, you know, that's pretty negative of you to keep smoking. Don't come back in my office until you stop, if he's a good doctor. That's another example of via negativa. We can't ignore the negative or we'll continue to be stuck in ignorance. I could go on now about that.
It also
that whole...
speaks to shedding.
Exactly, yeah.
And stripping down and getting to what's real.
Getting to the
mm-hmm.
Heartwood.
Heartwood, yeah.
This is marvelous that you're able to fill with my words now. We have come such a long way.
I doubt that. I heard that fire discourse so different this time.
Yeah.
Because you're ready to hear it differently.
Yeah.
Because you're different.
Yeah.
Mm.
As we came here on Thursday afternoon, we are going to leave, I think I said Monday, but we'll probably all leave tomorrow. We're going to leave completely, well, I'm not going to say completely, significantly different people than we were just a few short days ago. And what did that? Most people live their lives, what's that for? People live their lives in quiet desperation. Most people live their lives never realizing that they can change the way they think. And we've learned that we've gained the ability to think what we want to think whenever we want to. And they can all be pleasant, peaceful thoughts. Let's go have a cookie.
That's a pleasant piece.
That's a pleasant piece.
John, I gotta wait till next retreat since I was late, remember?
I'll give you what's the word? I'll give you a dispensation.
All right.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.